Hello and welcome to Adoptee Conversations from the Adoption and Fostering Podcast. In this episode of Adoptee Conversations, we talk to 26-year-old Dan. Dan tells us about his personal account of his adoption and his adoption journey. From being adopted as a baby, within his birth family, and how it's affected him in later years. This is Dan's personal adoption story. Therefore, it may not be reflective of others' experiences. If you have been affected by adoption in any way, then we suggest perhaps getting a friend to screen this podcast before you actually listen to it yourself. So I am with Dan, and Dan is an adoptee. Is that a term that you associate with, or
I would say it was a term I've only recently associated with.
Really?
I've always just referred to myself as adopted. I've never thought of myself an adoptee until recently, but I like it.
Yeah. Okay. That's good. So tell us a bit about you and your kind of background, if that makes sense.
My adoption story.
Yeah. Just tell us what you want people to hear. The good, the bad, and the very ugly.
There's nothing ugly about me. I am 26, but when I was born, it happened pretty quickly. My birth mother realised that she couldn't give me the care that I needed. And so I went to live with my grandparents for around 6 months. And the story goes is that they were getting a bit old and frail, and they went on holiday, and I went to live with my auntie and uncle for the 2 weeks that they were on holiday. I never really went back. I was adopted in family, which at the time you couldn't be legally adopted in family. It was classed as a legal guardianship, but now it is classed as an adoption. I was taken under the legal guardianship of my auntie and my uncle, so my birth mum's sister and her husband, who already had 3 children between them. And I have a real brother, if you like, a genetically real brother on my mother's side. But I don't class them as my family anymore. I class kind of this new version of my family as my only family, because they're all I've ever known. And then it wasn't until about 4 years ago when I started writing and talking about this that it became something. And ever since then, it's been a bit of a wild journey. I would say more so in the last 4 years has it been different, and have I only grasped the full understanding ever since I started talking about it so publicly. I kind of spent the years before that just accepting it and never really questioning it. Which isn't healthy, as a side note. Don't do that.
So that must add, I mean, so adoption in the UK at least is, I mean, it's already complex enough with, you know, kind of the reasons for coming into adoption. But that must add another layer as well in terms of, you know, still that connection with your first or your birth family. Sorry about my terminology, but that must add quite a complex layer to it as well, because it's always there.
Yeah, it's probably one of the biggest blessings and curses that go hand in hand. I'm incredibly grateful that I got 2 people in general who chose to love me and chose to kind of bring me up and raise me as their own. And as a side note to that, I got to stay close with my cousins growing up and my grandparents. I was still part of their life, and I was still very much part of my genetic life. I was still part of that life, but then again, it's a curse, because even now, every funeral, every wedding, every family event, I have to sit across my birth mother, and that's where it gets complicated. That's where it gets very hard sometimes, because it's a curse as well, because every family event, every wedding, every funeral, I have to sit across the table or the room from my birth mother, and it means that she's still connected enough that it serves as a reminder, but she's not connected enough, and that's mainly my choice, that it serves as a reminder that holds me back, if that makes any sense. Like, it's there, but it's not in the forefront of my mind. It's somewhere in the background, which it's a blessing and a curse.
So
When did you, I mean, have you, was there a time where you didn't know you were adopted?
Again, I think I'm one of those, what are they called? Anomalies. Is that the word? I'm an anomaly. No, I am different when it comes to adoption, I think, because I don't ever remember being told one way or the other. Conversations happened, and I can pinpoint conversations when I was 7, 8, 14, trying to learn and understand what was going on, but I don't ever remember not knowing that this was my situation, which I think is a good thing, because it either never happened as a big sit-down conversation, or it wasn't traumatic enough that it stuck out in my brain and kind of is something that I constantly fall back on. It's for me, it feels like a natural progression of learning over the years. And I have spoke to a few other adoptees and people in my circle as well, and they tend to agree that the best way to do it is naturally. So that it doesn't come as a shock. It's not a surprise.
Yeah. So that's, I mean, like I say, that probably adds another layer to it, but not just for you. I mean, it must kind of put in another layer for everybody around you as well. I mean, it's not about them, but do you feel the pressure of that, or is it just something that you've come to kind of accept and get on with?
That's a good question. It 100% adds another layer because of what happened and the events that have happened since. And I mean, my auntie and my uncle who adopted me have witnessed me growing up in anger and resentment at times. So it's definitely changed the way that my mum sees her sister, for example. And that then, because of the person I am a typical Pisces. I carry guilt. I carry a lot of weight on my shoulders. So I do feel responsible, because I almost, by staying in the family, which is what everyone wanted, I almost divided the family in some sense, because it has over the years, it's caused a lot of problems and it's caused a lot of arguments and a lot of resentment has been passed back and forth. I think the very important thing that my family as a whole set out from day one was that once this happened, it was final. There was no going back. There was no, my mum was never allowed to knock on my door at 2 o'clock in the morning and demand that she could take me back. And likewise, my mum and dad now could never knock on her door and say, we've had enough, take him back. That the family decided as a unit from day one that this was it. It's final. Yeah. There's no going back. So I think that saved a lot of arguments for us. And probably a lot of conversations, which is a good thing. But yeah, I definitely do feel a bit of responsibility for the divide that it caused, even though it's not my fault. You know, as adults, we decide for ourselves. We get to choose which path we take as adults. So it's completely their decision how they feel, if that makes sense.
Yeah.
But yeah, it doesn't stop me from carrying a bit of responsibility.
Yeah. And that must be... Sometimes that must be fine,
but sometimes
that must come to the, I'd imagine, I mean, I'm just assuming, I don't know.
Oh, 100%. I mean, I have a lot of resentment, a lot of very current resentment. I go through waves, but at the minute I'm really, really resenting my real brother because he got to stay with our mum, and he got to live the life that technically I should have been a part of, if you were looking at it realistically. So there's a lot of resentment there, but it was never his decision and it was never my decision. So the resentment almost falls on deaf ears, because no one's to blame for me and him being in the situation that we are. But it's very much like the musical Blood Brothers, where I don't know if you've ever seen it, but when
I have.
I was the narrator in the Year 7 version.
Oh, really? Well, I went to see it in the West End. That was the first musical I actually went to see. The irony, because I was not involved in this at that point. But yeah, go on, sorry.
No, but yeah, so for anyone that doesn't know, the story is that two twin boys, they're born and separated at birth. And effectively, we're not twins. He's older, but that is our story. And I was the one that got moved away to a different life. And I don't believe the tale, as it goes in the narrator's story of Blood Brothers, that if they meet, one of them will die. I don't believe that's going to happen. But I think that much time has passed now that I wouldn't know what to say, and probably he wouldn't know what to say either if we saw each other in the street. And that does, it causes a lot of resentment. I'm a question asker. I ask a lot of questions to myself. And I've got a lot of questions for him probably more so than my mum, because she was the adult and he was the child, so complicated.
It sounds it.
It's probably more complicated than kind of an out family adoption, I think, in some sense. Because you get, I think with an out of family adoption, it's almost like a clean break, if you like. Whereas a kind of you almost get to move on. And I'm not saying that people do move on, but there's a lot of clean breaks allowed. There's a lot of moving on allowed when you're completely starting again, whereas we've almost had to start again in the shadows of what was already there. So very complicated.
I guess the narrative is quite complicated in some ways, isn't it? Because it's the same, but it's very different. Just the impression of getting it. You know, it's because you've had similar experiences and you deal with day-to-day stuff that might actually be different, but you can connect it back to, I don't know, trauma or, you know, stuff like that, because you still experience that regardless of whether, you know, you're still quite secure within your wider family.
Yeah.
I guess. I mean, you know, I'm just making that assumption, so, which is really naughty because this is your conversation. I'm actually been making any assumptions.
Conversations between two people.
Exactly. Yeah, that's very true, actually. Yeah. All right, I'll go with that. So in terms of growing up then, I mean, This always interests me in some ways, because you would have reached an age where it would have been something that you want, you maybe, I'm imagining, just knowing the kind of person you are, hi, I'm adopted, that kind of thing. Was that ever a thing? Or, you know, or was it just like, you know, was it just, well, in the back of your head, you're adopted, but actually it never came up? Or what was it like growing up, knowing, you know, that you were...
It's funny because you've described me as a person. I remember being, I think I was 9 or 10 years old. I was ending primary school. Yeah. And this new girl came into primary school to finish with us. And the first thing I did, when people introduce themselves, you have to go around the class and tell them your name and your favourite colour. And instead of my favourite colour, I told her I was adopted.
Right. Yeah.
At the age of 10. So I've always been very open about it, but, and it's something I spoke about recently with Pick Me Up magazine. I did a thing for Mother's Day with them. And I mentioned in there how you go through phases. So that was probably the kind of the up wave. And then the down wave is that you're not ashamed of it, but you're a bit, you don't want to tell people it's your story. It's your secret. And then the wave picks up again. And probably, like I say, 4 years ago, is when I started really announcing it, because I think I'd spent so long trying to fight the fact that, oh, they shouldn't define me, they shouldn't be who I am. I stopped doing that and I started embracing it, because I think it is quite interesting. It's quite, there's a lot of questions that I ask of, is it nature versus nurture? And I know a lot of adoptees ask that question too. And I already almost had this platform when I came into talking about adoption, because I'd spent a few years talking about mental health before that. And it felt almost right to begin asking questions to other adopters and other adoptees about, you know, are you ashamed of it? Do you feel proud of it? Is it just me? And that's where the wave came up. But that all being said, every other month, people tell me that I look like my brother, which is physically impossible, because he's my adopted dad's son from a different marriage.
Right.
Okay. So the only thing we have in common is a beard, and it is a very similar beard. I mean, his is better than mine, but people tell us we look the same. And the second we kind of say, oh, that's impossible, I'm adopted, which we do, because it's quite funny to us to see their reaction, which is an evil thing to do. The thing they always say is, oh, well, you've got the same beard. And by that sense, I would imagine I'm related to half of the UK. But I could be.
So it does strike me that you have a different perception about all of this, a different kind of approach to all of this. So you mentioned there about, you know, up to 4 years ago, and then you started embracing it. So what you've obviously reflected on that, and but what was it like before you started to embrace it? Was it a difficult thing to deal with?
Yes, I think it's one of those things that you can't fight.
Mm-hmm.
And like I say, I spent so long fighting it, so I was very ashamed, of the fact that, I think for me personally, it was the fact that it wasn't the fact I was adopted, it wasn't the fact that I was adopted in family, it was the fact that I was adopted and my brother got to stay. Because it brought up, and it still does bring up from time to time, this whole, well, why wasn't I good enough, or, you know, what made us different in that sense. And logistically and factually, what made us different was that he was already developed, he was 4. So he was a child, he wasn't a baby. And so probably it was easier for me because he already had his life, he already knew who his mum and dad was. But that doesn't stop. That's what I've spent most of my life being angry with, is the fact that he got to stay and I didn't. And I spent so long doing that in silence that anyone who talks or deals with mental health will know that doing it in silence is the worst thing you can do, because it just swirls round and round your head. And unless you're putting it out there, it's got nowhere to go. So it builds. And up until 4 years ago, that's all it did, was build. And it's not a good place to be.
Yeah. So do you think, I mean, your mental health is as a result of kind of carrying that at the time?
Yeah, my mental health, I mean, yeah, 4 or 5 years ago, mental health was a bad place for me. And it was all down to that. There was a number of different things in my life, but they all stem back from my adoption being the first one. And I think you do. I think you go through phases with adoption. I called it recently the second childhood, because I think once you accept it, so post 4 years ago, once you accept and understand and start to work through it as an adult, I think you start to learn more about it consciously and maturely. Because growing up, you're stuck in this infant head or this child's head, wondering why you weren't good enough for mum and dad. That's the only question you ask yourself. And that's where the mental health builds, because if, as you get older, you realise, well, if I wasn't good enough for mum and dad, am I not going to be good enough for X person or Y person? And then it carries on, and you always try and better yourself, but by bettering yourself, you're exhausting yourself, because you're not going back to you're not understanding the root of the problem. And I think, yeah, definitely, up until 4 years ago, that's what I was doing. And it's only post 4 years that I've learned to understand it. And I've learned to ask the other questions surrounding it of, well, if I wasn't, if my mother and I couldn't be together, why is that? And let's learn the facts about it. Let's not just ask yourself the question. I think one piece of advice I give to everyone is, if you can, and if it's safe to do so, always ask for the facts, because they help.
Wow. So that kind of connects into something I was thinking about there, was about, where did you get that help from? I mean, how, you know, there must, we know, because we do have ears and we try and listen as much as possible as kind of adoptive parents, that mental health's a big issue. It's a big issue generally at the minute, but, you know, especially when it's, you know, our own kind of community. Because, and by community, I'm talking, you know, I like to think that we're all part of one community, regardless of how we've been thrown together. And mental health is a massive thing for our community. So was there things that you, was there must be a point, a tipping point for you? I'm stumbling a little bit because I'm just not sure what question I'm going to ask you, but I know what I want to ask. So there must have been a tipping point for you. And how did you, you know, how did you access help for that? Or did you? Or was it just something that you went, I just need to talk about, you know, what kind of form did that take for you?
Aha, that's a good question, now that I understand it. I spent my teenage years, 14, 15, 16, being very, very angry, to the point where I would tell my mum and dad that they would never be my mum and dad. They can't tell me what to do. They're not my real mum and dad. There'd be occasions where my mum would have to drive me to her sister's, my other auntie, because she couldn't deal with me. I was being that angry and that out of control that I'd have to go away. But the kind of downside is that my mum works as a social worker. That's what she did before she retired. So she knew every trick in the book. There was no screaming at her that was ever going to get a reaction. I remember once telling them that they treated me horribly and therefore I was going to go to the police. They weren't treating me horribly. I was just backlashing. My mum being a social worker, she drove me to the police station and she said, off you go, go and tell them what you want to tell them. And obviously being 15, I was like, no, it's fine, I'm okay now. And that was, yeah, but I spent a lot of my teenage years doing that. And then at the age of 19, I moved to my first, like, university. I moved away. And it was the time where I was learning to do things on my own, and I was being an adult, and I was in a serious relationship. And then 4 years ago, that all ended. The relationship ended, and the university ended. And I think that's when it all hit me, because I was a bit like, now what? I've spent my teenage years being angry. I've spent the last 4 years, like the first 4 years of my adult life, being in a serious relationship and working and studying away from home. And now I'm moving home because I had to move back. And it was taking those steps back that that's where I realized I needed the help. But it all came to a head one day when I was due to move out of my old flat. And just lost myself in it. It was change. Adoption and change go very hand in hand. Mm-hmm. And I think a lot of the change that I was going through in my life brought up a lot of change from the adoption. And within a week, I'd called a therapist, I'd called a doctor. And now I'm just coming up to 2 years in therapy, mostly because of adoption. But there's a lot of other things, as always, with life.
Well, life does tend to do that, doesn't it?
Life does that. And that's my one life advice for everyone is, even if you don't think you need it, get yourself a therapist. Even if you just want to talk about how bad the day was, like your day was in work because the phone line wasn't working. Like, just having that safe space saves everything, and it helps you process everything. It's good.
Wow. There's so much within that, what you've just said, because, yeah, there just is. I think that actually, you know, whether you're adopted or not, so a lot of people could do with therapy.
I meet new people, I'm like, have you got a therapist? Do you need one? I carry my therapist business cards around. I've got them in my wallet. He probably loves me. That's probably why he keeps me. I'm probably cured now, but he's like, hold on. Dan's bringing me people.
Are you still paying? That's the thing, yeah.
Unfortunately. I don't get a discount for handing business cards.
So, and I hope you don't mind me mentioning this, and if you do, we can take it out. But you've got another layer in there as well, is coming to terms with sexuality.
Yes. Yeah.
Well, I mean, what has that? My days. You know, I'm gay as well. But has that added, like, just another layer onto all of the stuff that you have to process? I mean, I don't know. I mean, I'm just imagining me, but bearing in mind I'm a lot older than you dealing with that.
What?
But yeah, I know. I know I don't look any older, but whatever. But is it something that just really kind of, you know, was it like almost like a pressure cooker, all this stuff for you? Or was it just... Or was that actually quite a minimal thing? You know, you grew up in a different time to me.
I think I grew up on the cusp. So I think now it's very accepted and open. I mean, obviously, we've got wars raging on about LGBT debates and things, education debates and things. But I was on the cusp where there was still no same-sex couples exampled in textbooks, for example.
Yeah.
We were never taught about them in school, but you weren't necessarily at as much risk of violence or danger for being gay or bisexual, and it was a lot more accepted. But I thought I dealt really well with my sexuality until I was 15, 16, the very famous angry years. And I read I googled why people are gay, because I didn't understand it. And I heard someone or something say that it was a choice or whatever. So I googled it, and one of the first things I read was that I don't know now how much of this statistic is true, just a disclaimer, but I read at the time that men who don't have relationships with their birth fathers were 10 times more likely to be gay. So that immediately, for me, I don't think in hindsight that is ever going to be true. But at the time I believed it because I latched onto it. I was like, oh well, I don't know my birth dad and I think I'm gay, so that's the match, there's the match. And I spent a long time then being angry at him, and I've spoken about this a lot in my own life and online, but I don't feel anything towards him because I never knew him. He was out of my life before I was born, and I've never seen him since. And that's fine with me. I've never felt any resentment because he just backed off. He just went off and lived his life. But it's the first time I remember being really, really angry at him, because at the time, and I don't know if you went through this when you were kind of understanding your sexuality, but you fight it a little bit, or you decide that, you know, you want to be normal, quote unquote. You want to be straight. You want to have, at the time, wife and children. And I remember being really angry at him for not allowing me to do that. And therefore, I was forever, in my opinion at the time, going to be scarred and different because he left me. Now, as a 26-year-old, in the world that we live in, I realise how ridiculous that sounds.
Mm.
And, yeah, but I think at the time, I was very, very, very angry at him for it.
Mm.
Very angry. So it did. It added a whole other layer to it.
Yeah. That's interesting. It's interesting how it connects back to that as well. So there's, at the time, you were, from what you've just said there, in my head, sorry, but you've connected those kind of early thoughts about your sexuality back to your experience of being adopted.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I have to switch myself off from doing that these days. Because I think it's very easy, because we're, as adoptees, looking for answers almost all the time. And right. It's very easy for you to not switch off, to constantly ask it down to really, really minimal things. Like, oh, did I just do that because I'm adopted? And it could be as simple as forgetting your umbrella when it's raining outside. Like, your brain is like, becomes ingrained and entwined to constantly ask yourself that question. Now, did I do this because I'm adopted? Am I doing that because I'm adopted? And you definitely have to switch yourself off. Otherwise, you end up completely losing yourself in it.
Yeah. You've given me a lot of food for thought with this, I tell you. it's just really interesting because, you know, we all have our different experience of, you know, finding ourselves, sexuality, but just adding that other layer on there must be almost like a mind-numbing kind of thing.
Exhausting.
Yeah. So, and... as an adult, because you are a fully fledged adult now.
Just rolling my eyes.
Yeah, it's not all as cracked up to be, is it? what's kind of, you know, because anybody who follows you online will know that, you know, you're very open and honest about how you're feeling on a day-to-day basis. But
too honest, someone said.
Well, is that a connection, or is it just that you are the kind of person who just shares, or, you know, I mean, do you find that that's about your kind of your life and stuff like that, or is it just, you know,
I think naturally I'm very confident in oversharing because, I mean, very cliche, but in primary school, high school, college and university, I studied performing arts. That's all I did, was stand on a stage and deliver. And then when university ended, I had no stage anymore, so Twitter became my stage. But that aside, obviously I was adopted, and then at 15-ish, I met my first boyfriend, which is very young. Yes, very, very young. And I was with him for nearly 3 years, and then he took his own life on Halloween. And then if we fast forward to last year, my mum was diagnosed with breast cancer. And at these points in my life, it's not so much about, oh, I must share this story, it's juicy or it's headline grabbing. It's more, at the time, I've never known, or I've never been with people who are going through the same thing. And I think loneliness has been the hardest bit for me to deal with, because, you know, it's very hard for me to turn around and say to my best friends, oh, when I was adopted, or, you know, I saw my real mum in Asda last weekend, which was a heart-stopping moment, but I had no one to tell. So my first thing to do was tell Twitter, because it's full of this community where, you know, and most of it is down to the adoption conference last year, may I add. That's where I met most of the kind of adoption related people, but they all jump to it because they understand it, or they at least can empathize with how that must feel. And I almost don't want to put that on my real life best friends because they don't understand it, and I think it would hurt them more to not understand it. So at those points in my life, the adoption, the suicide, my mum's cancer last year, it was very easy for me to put it online. A, because I know how it feels for no one to understand it, so at least if it's there, it's documented for in a year's time if someone else is going through it. So then they can find me, and then we've almost got this almost understanding relationship. But then also, yeah, I think it's easier for you to meet people who understand online. Well, people get it.
So is that a big issue for you? Because you just said there it's easier to do it online than it is to do with your own friends.
Reading between the lines.
Well, that's just what I'm picking up. I'm just picking it up.
I'm going to start paying you instead of my therapist. But yes, you are correct. I don't struggle. So going through my adoption in my angry years, I never once told my mum and dad that it was because I was adopted. They knew it was because I was adopted, but I never used those words. I just presumed that every 15-year-old was very angry at the world, which most of them are. I was very angry at the world. And then when I went through my relationship and that crumble with suicide and things, I never told them. It took me, probably even still now, they're still learning things about that relationship. Because at the time, I thought it was easier to just carry on. It happened on the Thursday and I went back to college on the Monday. And I didn't tell anyone. I just carried on my life because I'm not someone who likes to burden other people with their problems in person. But if you meet me on Twitter, I will burden you with everything, only because it's easier. It takes away that someone can't look at you like they're disappointed.
Right.
And if I don't like what they're saying, or if they don't like what I'm saying, then it's a matter of unfollow, block, remove. This isn't working. Let's carry on. Whereas, yeah, no one wants to face the disappointment in real life. Mm. That's something that I have to deal with quite a lot.
Yeah. Imagine you do, because as a human being, I think that people would hate for people to feel like that. I would imagine the majority of us, but if that's, I guess that must be almost like a coping mechanism for you,
yeah,
in some ways, because you don't want to be put in that. I'm just making this assumption. You don't want to be put in that position where you feel like that, so actually it's easier to kind of put it somewhere else.
Yeah. But
then if it does happen, which I would imagine it wouldn't, but I just, you know, I don't know.
I think these days I'm very different to kind of how I used to be. So I find it very easy now to sit down and tell my mum what's going on or tell my friends what's going on. But I still find it easier to put it in 240 characters and tweet it. Because just, in my opinion, you're still getting it out there. And it's not healthy, and it's not the best way to do it by any means. But I think once it's out there, it's out there. And then you can almost close the chapter and carry on. You can kind of leave the book where it was and then just move on with your life. Which doesn't work, especially in today's age, because we are all so connected through social media now. I had my Twitter anniversary the other day where you get your notification, and it's 10 years I've been on Twitter. And back when Twitter started, you could tweet this kind of thing and no one would reply because I had 12 followers. No one cared. And now here I am, a couple of thousand followers later, and people care. So yeah, you can't do it as much anymore. Maybe I should just set my own kind of locked Twitter up, just no followers, just tweet it.
I don't know if you would use it then, would you?
No, I wouldn't. I care too much. My blog, that's what my whole blog is about, is kind of, if I share it on there, it's out there. My mum's emailed subscribed to my blog recently, which I think is adorable. And now she comes to me, and she's like, "Oh, I read this," and she like kind of almost prints it off and highlights it when she's like, "Oh, page 3," and then she goes through it. But that gives her the power then, which I appreciate. Like, she can then come to me when she's read something or she wants to understand more. It doesn't have to be me sitting down trying to make her understand. Which I think is where a lot of the fear comes from in general life, not just with my mum.
Yeah.
She's not that scary.
No. Really interesting. So I've got one last question for you, because you touched on, well, you've mentioned it a couple of times. You went to university, which is...
Three times.
More than I have.
Only
Oh, right, okay. but it's an interesting thing because the kind of majority of young people who are adopted within the last, well, I don't know. I mean, it's difficult to put a time frame on it, but they have so many issues around education. I'm not putting words into your mouth, but do you think that there was any issues with you within your education experience that came from adoption, or do you think actually it didn't really affect that, with the exception of oversharing with your new classmates, obviously?
I never struggled in primary school, never once. And then the only struggle that ever came, adoption related, was nothing to do with my actual education. It was more when there was a school trip and your parents would have to sign the form to say you could go. My mum and dad would have to circle the legal guardian box. And I remember that being a big issue for me. And I don't know why, but it was never the issue that it was happening to me. I felt really sorry for my mum and dad having to tick that box rather than just ticking the mum and dad box. And it was only when I was in my last year of high school and we were going on our residential trip that I told my mum to tick the real box because no one would know. I mean, they probably knew because there was years of permission slips and before that. But I did my first university. I did for 11 months. I went to Leeds and I dropped out. I quit because I didn't like being away from home. You could argue that that was adoption related. Maybe I didn't want to be away from it. But at the time, I just remember being incredibly homesick, which now never happens. I'm not a homesick person. I like to be away. I like to be constantly moving. But yeah, it took me two attempts to get university right, and I think the only reason I passed the second time is because I already had friends when I went there. We all went as a collective. There was four of us that went together, and we lived together, and we studied together, and we worked together. So it was familiar. I think a lot of adoptees, myself included, struggle with when things aren't familiar, especially long-term settings. So I think the prospect of university is quite daunting because you're changing your life for 3, maybe 4 years. And it's the first time that a lot of people are away from home. So it is a daunting experience. But I think the best thing I did the second time around was going to a local university.
Right.
I still lived away, but it was 12 minutes on the train from where my mum and dad's house was.
Yeah.
It was close enough I could run back to, but far enough I could still get in trouble and them not know anything.
Oh, your poor parents.
I know. Can't wait for this to air. She's going to come with another list of highlighted moments.
I'll send her a manuscript. What's it called? Anyway, it's been really interesting because everybody's got a different experience of adoption. The one thing I did want to ask you, Phil, was, well, there's two things I wanted to ask you. What the chance of kind of people who are kind of 15 are very slim listening to this, but they might pick up. What would you say to two different people? One who's adopted, who's a young man who's adopted, who is angry, who feels like you did at 15, and the other question is, what would you say to that same person with questions over their own sexuality? So there might be one response to this, there might be 12 responses to this, I don't know, but what would your advice be?
The first question I think is the toughest, so I'm going to try and tackle that one first.
Go on.
I think the best tip that I was ever given, and I was only given it kind of in the last 2 years by my therapist and then my mum, was that it's okay to be angry. It's okay to feel it. It's okay to have questions and feel resentment or feel anger. It's something that you are going to feel on and off over the years as you come to learn new situations or you come to revisit things as an adult. But it's what you do with the anger and it's what you do with the resentment that's the most important bit. Lashing out and telling your mum you're going to call the police and then have her drive you to a police station knowing you're not going to do anything is not the best thing to do with it. When I was 17, and I was in college, you could finally pick what you were doing with your life. And I think one of the best things I ever did, and this will go into a whole other argument of the education system, one of the best things I ever did was pick a creative course, something that allows you to express yourself in a different way. Because I just think having an outlet, having somewhere else to go and escape, whether it's art or music or dance, or they're probably doing courses in blogging these days, just find that creative outlet. It's very cliche, but a lot of people who grew up with diaries will tell you how emotionally free they feel because they got it all out at the time. So find the best way for you to do it, rather than hold on to it. Don't make the mistake I did of holding on to it. Mm-hmm. That's the best advice I could give. Okay. In terms of sexuality, don't Google it. It's the worst you do. Like anything.
I'm blessed not to have had Google in the 1980s, I'm going to be honest. But yeah, go on.
Did you even have dial-up in the 1980s?
No, we didn't have any internet in the 1980s, love. Sorry about that. Yeah, I know. Yeah.
Born in the right time.
Oh no, how we lived our lives. Anyway.
Yeah, don't Google it. Do not Google anything. That's my best advice for life. It's really hard because I think people develop at different stages. So someone might, at the age of 15, might realise that they're gay. Some people at the age of 15 might be questioning whether they are. And some at 15 may think they're straight. And then in 10 years' time, they're ready to kind of understand and accept that they're not. But I think feel it out safely. I think education systems are a lot better these days in offering support and offering help. Because even when I was there 10 years ago, I left high school this year. And there was nothing. There was no LGBT support group. There was no teacher that I knew I could talk to about these situations. Mm. And I think that would have been a massive help. That would have been something, you know, we trust adults as teenagers and as kids. And I think finding that adult that you can trust and confide in, I think that is the best thing you can do, because sometimes you don't want to go home and tell your mum. Or sometimes you don't want to tell your best friend because at the time you feel scared that they're not going to be your best friend anymore. Mm. But I think and this might be controversial advice, so I apologize in advance. But I think if you are questioning your sexuality at whatever age, I think it's important to know that you have to go on a journey, because then in 5-6 years' time, that questioning stage, it doesn't necessarily matter anymore. You've come through the other side and embrace who you are. It's Pride Month, after all.
It is. It's Pride Month. You are correct.
There's a lot of debates going on about that word.
Yeah, well, you know, that's just life, isn't it? Yeah. Yeah.
Embrace it. Find
yourself. Great advice. Great advice. That's your advice. It's not my advice, but if it was my advice, I would say exactly the same, even as an old git of a gay bloke who, you know, came out like 25 zillion years before.
Interesting though, because I remember, I think I was about 11 or 12, and there was two men kissing on TV, which at the time, so that's what, 2004, 2005, which at the time is still quite unheard of. Mm. And I remember my dad doing the whole typical macho dad thing where he was like, yuck, that's disgusting. And at the time, I hadn't necessarily understood I was gay, or I hadn't kind of even thought about it, but I remember being really angry at him, mm-hmm. and telling him he was wrong for thinking that,
yeah.
but then kind of just moving on, and probably looking back, that was me saying like, because hello, that's me.
Oh dear.
Interesting, because yeah. I think you always know. I used to play with Barbies growing up,
yeah,
but no one would ever question it at the time, because it was right. It's just a 4-year-old playing with Barbie dolls.
Mm-hmm.
But if there was a Barbie and a Ken, I would always go for Barbie. I had a Spice Girls doll when I was 7 that I threw up on. Yeah, it was a Mel C doll, and I threw up on her.
Well, if Mel C's listening, I'm sure she's gutted to hear
she's
that.
She's going to bar me for the next reunion.
Yeah, she is, isn't she? Yeah, yeah. Well, listen, Dan, thank you very much. Is there anything else that you would want to say to our listeners in terms of, you know, about anything? Is there anything else you'd want to say before I mute you and then kick you off?
I don't even think so. I think I've said enough.
It's not like you.
This is my first ever podcast, and I think it might be my last ever podcast. I'll stick to the blogs from now on, because I can just delete stuff out.
Well, we can delete anything that you want once you get this sent to you. Well, thank you. I appreciate your time. And as ever, this is Dan's story. It's all about Dan. And as ever, Dan's experience will be very different to other people's experiences. But we do appreciate your perspective, because I think that there's so, you know, adoption, long-term fostering, SGOs, there's so many different layers to it that actually if there's one point that you've made tonight that helps someone else, then it's been a worthy hour.